Way back when I was thinking about starting a high-ticket dropshipping business, the one thing I was looking for was someone to show me what one of these sites looks like. So John and I have done that for you at dropshipbreakthrough.com/go. So head to dropshipbreakthrough.com/go and watch the free training.
Welcome to the Dropship Podcast, where you'll learn how to build and grow a high-ticket dropshipping business and hear stories from successful e-commerce entrepreneurs. Let's kick this thing off.
Hey, welcome back to the Dropship Podcast. John with you today for a solo episode. No Ben today. In today's episode, you're going to listen back to a live session I did just a couple of weeks ago, a dropshipping Ask Me Anything session. So we do these usually in our Facebook group, our free and public Facebook group. If you're not a member there yet, head into the show notes. Or if you're watching on YouTube, check out the description below this video and you'll find a link to that Facebook group. It's a high-ticket dropshipping-focused Facebook group. You can join for free. And in that group, we do usually a weekly training session and cover all sorts of different topics. But what I do every now and then is an Ask Me Anything session where I ask people what questions they've got around business, around high-ticket dropshipping. And then I jump on a day later or so and answer all of those questions live, as well as take incoming questions from people who are joining me for the live training. So if you'd love to join that sort of thing and learn more about high-ticket dropshipping, get into that Facebook group. All you got to do is request entry and we'll let you in. But here, you're going to hear the recording of the last Ask Me Anything I did. And I got a whole bunch of great questions about high-ticket dropshipping, ranging from questions around shipping, around supplier red flags, what's a realistic time frame to hit $10 million in revenue with one of these businesses. We had questions about profit margins and a whole bunch of other great stuff. So this is a bit of a longer episode than what we normally do. I think it clocks in at just over an hour, but there is a bunch of gold in here. So listen to it through. And without further ado, here's the first question. First question today comes from Jill. Jill asks, what is the average turnaround for US supplier / distributors to ship a product? A very popular brand I would love to resell. Put me in touch with their US distributor with four US warehouses, gross profit margins are 24%, but was told 7 to 10 days to ship out order. Is this a common turnaround time? Well, good question, Jill. I'd say probably that turnaround time is on the, you know, it's not fast, certainly, and it's probably a bit more than average. You know, it's not super slow, but it's certainly a bit longer than average. I think average turnaround time for you know, when you place an order with your supplier to it getting packaged up and shipped out is probably 2 to 3 days. Some suppliers / distributors do it faster than that. Some take a little bit longer though. I mean, I work with some who probably it's more like 4 or 5 days. 7 to 10 days is further, and I guess, you know, if that's the way it is with them and that's the way they do it for everybody, then you're not really at a disadvantage. But I probably would be making sure that if that's the way it goes, that, you know, you make it clear to customers on the product pages for the products that you're getting from that distributor is that the shipping time is 7 to 10 days, or the, you know, dispatch time is 7 to 10 days. You know, I would probably personally dig into that a little bit with them and just see why is that the case. So why is it going to take so long to ship out a product? You know, if it's something to do with shipping, you might be able to explore whether you booking the shipping yourself, which is something you can do. It's not difficult to do at all. Might speed the process up, or if there's any avenues to speed it up. I mean, if the product's ready to go and it just, you know, needs to be picked and then labeled and shipped out, I don't really see why it would need to take that long, but they may have some internal process that you're not aware of that requires it to take that long. Maybe they have to package the goods up, or maybe, you know, they package them up or do something, you know, pre-shipping them that you're not aware of. And if that makes sense and that's the way it needs to be, that's the way it needs to be. The most important thing is, if it's going to be the case, is
And you can totally work with 7 to 10 days, right? I mean, if that's the way it is, that's the way it is. Those margins are a good starting point with them. So it's I think it's worth doing. But you just need to make sure that you manage customer expectations, right? So and you do that by communicating those sort of times on your product pages so that when somebody puts in an order for those products, they're very aware that it might take a little bit longer than other products you might have on your site or what they're used to. I would also follow up and reconfirm that time frame or those time frames in your post-order emails that you might send to a customer, which can be automated for those products. So good question, Jill. Thank you. I'm going to jump along now to a question that Kathleen has sent in, and this is an SEO / content related question. The question is, how do you tackle product comparison content without impacting your relationship with suppliers? So for example, a piece of content that compares brand A to brand B. Not an uncommon piece of content to put together for SEO purposes. Oftentimes versus type search terms are really good quality. They're middle of the funnel. They're easy to rank for oftentimes by putting up a good piece of content that answers that question of brand A versus brand B, or it might be product A versus product B, or there might be three things you compare or something like that. How do you tackle it without impacting your relationship with suppliers? Think about a few things, right? I think oftentimes, these are easiest to write when it's a brand that you have versus a brand that you don't. Obviously there you can be a bit more biased and those may exist in your market. You can be a bit more biased with those, obviously. But where you carry both of the brands, I wouldn't overthink it. A lot of times your supplier is not even going to read it. Sometimes they are. Stick to the facts. Stick to the facts based on what the supplier has provided you about their products. You're not looking to, make any. You don't need to make anything up here. You're just going to say these are brand A. And it's probably not really brand A. It's probably going to be the question that people ask is not really going to be brand A versus brand B. Like if a brand has 50 products versus brand B that's got 25, like the customer's not comparing the brand. If they're asking a question that's brand A versus brand B, they're probably more thinking of particular products from those brands that you're comparing, right? So you're going to stick to the facts. Like these are the features and benefits of product A. These are the features and benefits of product B. It's facts. Like you can't, you can't sort of deviate from that. And then, provide some guidance as to what that means, what outcomes those provide, and, what that might mean for the outcome that the customer is seeking when they're purchasing those products. It's not like you have to, when you're doing a comparison at the end of that piece of content, say, I would recommend everybody only buys brand A because it's better, or product A. What customers want when they're making that search term is an ability to compare the two, get the full information about the pros and cons of each product on a page where they can easily compare them and then make a call based on all of those factors as to what might be the best outcome for them. So the way that you can manage that is to, one, be factual, and two, don't provide a clear recommendation at the end. You don't have to. You could go more so you've always got to bring it back to the outcome that the customer wants, right? And if you know anything about your market and your ideal customer, you're going to have some ideas about that sort of thing. You might come back and say, well, product A is great if you're, the products, let's say the products have different prices. Product A is great if you're working on a budget. Product B is great if you are happy to spend a little bit more and want to get these additional features, X, X, and X, which will mean this, this, and this for you. Outcome, 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 right? So it's never a case necessarily. I mean, if I was doing brand A versus a brand I don't sell, I probably would go and provide a recommendation and say, well, clearly the product I sell is better than the other one. You could get a bit closer to that. But, brand A versus brand B, you've got both. you know, the only thing that's going to might annoy a supplier there is if, one, either you state something that's not correct about their product, or two, you say, buy somebody else's product and don't buy this one. And when you sell both, why would you do that anyway? It's about finding the good in each product, which might be different, you know, you're going to have customers usually who are seeking different variations of outcomes from the same type of product, right? And so highlight what the different positive outcomes are from each product. And that means you'll be finding customers for both. So good question though, Kathleen. Thank you very much for sending that in. Next question, pre-submitted. And then I'm going to get into some of our live questions. Thank you guys who are watching along live. We're going to get to those in a tick. Next question is from Dan. Dan asks, what to look for, both plus pros and cons in a 3PL service? So a third-party logistics service. That's if you're not familiar with that term, 3PL means a third-party warehouse that will, not your supplier and not you, but a third party that you can send products to, they will store products for you and they will ship them out when you receive orders. And so these can be useful if you get into the stage of purchasing products in bulk for your business and you don't want to maintain your own warehouse, because sometimes the cost of doing that, you're not quite at that level yet. Or they can also be useful. Sometimes you'll find suppliers who like require you to buy products on bulk in order to open an account with them, which some people will do. And so you obviously then need, if you're buying 5 or 10 of the whatever the products are, you got to put them somewhere. But that's not probably enough volume for you to open up your own warehouse space. So we have these third-party logistics services that that you can use. And so they will manage that whole warehousing and fulfillment side of things for you. So I guess what would I be looking for in a 3PL service if I were going to work for one of those? I would be primarily looking, one of the big things I would be looking at is cost, right? So what's the cost? What's the cost for storing a pallet per pallet of goods or per whatever their measurement is? What's the cost to handle that, both receiving and then sending out? You know, what shipping companies do they work with? Or, you know, are you going to be putting in the shipping? What are the costs of that? So you want to get into the nuts and bolts of what are all the costs. It's not going to be just one cost. Usually they'll have a cost for this, a cost for that, a cost for the other thing. So you've got to put those together, obviously, and weigh up against, well, what products am I going to be putting in there? What's the profit margin on those products? What do I think my cost per sale is going to be? And then can I carry that additional cost? Does it make sense given the margin that I have from the place wherever I'm getting supply of those products? So you've got to think about that. You have to think about, you know, like how quickly am I moving these products? Like, am I going to get charged, you know, per time period, per product stored? So like, am I going to be crossing over multiple time periods of storage that I'm going to have to pay for here? Or do I think I'm going to move them, you know, fairly quickly? So cost is a pro or a con. The cost has to meet your business needs for it to be worthwhile. You can find 3PLs with all sorts of different costs. So it does make sense from that perspective to shop around, because there are certainly some that are better than others. And we have one that we're now recommending at Dropship Breakthrough in the US. And I'm on the lookout for one in Australia that we can recommend as well. So if anybody who's in Dropship Breakthrough, students, wants a recommendation there, just message me directly and I can help you out with a name there. Good business that Ben uses and uses for his own products and has been using for a while. So we know they're good. Other things I'm going to be looking at is like, probably small things, but like, what's the space look like, you know, security, all that sort of thing. Like, are your products going to be looked after? What are their handling timeframes? You know, you put an order in, how long is it going to take them to pick that and get it ready for shipping? What are their targets there? What do they say they're going to hit? once again, comparisons, you know, and then, yeah, what shipping arrangements? Do they provide shipping? What's the speed of those? All of that sort of thing. So, look, I mean, honestly, it's a pretty simple thing. I don't think there's a ton that you need to dig into here. So both pros and cons, to me, it comes back to time, to speed, and cost. And that's primarily what I'm weighing up. In a larger country like the US or Australia, I'd be thinking about location as well, potentially. Like, you know, it's obviously probably better to have a central location when you're drop shipping because you could have products going in there from all over the place. You could have products going to the whole country. And so getting a 3PL that's on a far corner of the country doesn't make sense because all of your shipping costs from there are going to be bigger than they need to be, primarily. Whereas if you have somewhere that's central, you're more likely to have a fairly average, shipping cost. And once again, if I were in Australia, you know, I would probably be looking at one on the East Coast because that's where the bulk of Australia's population is. So most of my products are probably going to ship to people on the eastern side of the country, whereas it wouldn't make sense to get one in, say, the western side of the country or the south or something like that, like South Australia. That wouldn't make any sense. So think about that as well. But it's pretty simple. Don't overthink that. All right, thanks for that question, Dan. Right, we're going to jump on to some of our live questions, and thank you. Keep those live questions coming as well, guys. I'm going to dive into these in no particular order, must be said. I will get to everybody's questions, but I'm going to go no particular order here, and I'm going to look at this so I can get some names. Jordan asks, and thank you for jumping on, Jordan. What are the average profit margins for a drop shipping business? Oh, good question. I'm going to come at that from a high ticket drop shipping perspective, of course, because that's all we talk about here. I have no idea about low ticket drop shipping and I could not care less. So I'm not going to talk about that. High ticket drop shipping. So you have two levels of profit that we can talk about. You have gross profit, which is the profit you get from your supplier before you take out any costs. And then you have your net profit, which is the profit you've got after you take out all of your costs. So costs like, you know, advertising, your subscriptions to things like Shopify, you know, paying a virtual assistant if you've got a virtual assistant, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, your net profit indicates the amount of money that you're going to be putting in your pocket that you could take out of the business pre-tax. So gross profit margins on average, and these are pretty consistent no matter what country you're doing this in. So it doesn't really vary a lot, US to Australia to the UK or anywhere else. Average gross profits are going to be, I think at this point in time, and they've maybe changed a little bit over time, not a lot, but you're probably looking at about 25%. So that's, you know, you're going to be buying the product at this price, you're going to be selling it at this price. Margin, 25%. I'd say that's average. Now, you will see suppliers who have higher than that. So I personally have suppliers who have profit margins up to 50%, some in the 40%. And then I have some that are lower than that, lower than 25%. So it might be 20%, 15%. And so you get a range, but average, 25%. Net profit, what you tend to see, and once again, when we talk about net profit, there's obviously a lot of factors that can feed into that. Different businesses do different things. And then you have the question of scale or not. So as in, net profit can often look different when you're at 20,000 a month in sales to when you're at 1 million a month in sales, right? And we tend to talk about this in percentage terms, and you know, people tend to think funny things about percentage terms. But what we've seen over the years, once again, incredibly consistent here, as in it's the same today roughly as it was 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago, is that at scale, so I'm not going to talk about what's the profit margins when you're at 20,000 in sales because that's not the aim here. Nobody's aiming to start one of these businesses and just make 20,000 in sales. right? I mean, realistically, over time, we want to make more than that. So at scale, like getting up into businesses that are multiple seven-figure-a-year businesses up to eight-figure-a-year businesses, which is 10 million plus in annual sales, you're looking on average at 15% net. So that's after all of your profits out. All of your costs are out, advertising, you know, everything's out, 15%. Now, some people think that's low, but that's actually the average for US businesses of all types in the US is 15% net profit margins, or at least the last time I checked it was. So it's about average. So you do the numbers there, obviously, on $1 million in sales, that's $150,000 that's going in your pocket. And when you get down into lower numbers, your profit margins may be a bit higher, and in different markets and different niches, profits vary, cost of advertising varies, all of that sort of thing. But on average, 15%, there's people out there who are doing 20%, net, you know, at decent numbers. And there's people out there who are doing 16%, 17%, 18%, probably 22%, et cetera, et cetera. So there's variations there. But that's what you can see. And like I say, I mean, we've got firsthand experience with eight-figure-a-year businesses, and that tends to be the number. It can vary a little bit around there, 14, 16, 15, 14 and a half, but it stays pretty, it's usually pretty consistent around that, you know, with the type of marketing that we do for these businesses. So, you know, once again, do the numbers. If you can grow one of these businesses to $10 million in sales, that means you're taking out $1.5 million. In your pocket. That's in your pocket. That's not before tax, anything comes out. That's your pre-tax personal income. That's what it could be. So obviously that's been done. So it's possible. And obviously, you know, you don't even have to get there, and you've got a really healthy amount of profit coming out. All right. Thank you, Jordan, for that question. I'm going to go on to Kenny. Kenny asks thoughts on solar generators. So thoughts, I imagine, as in, are they a good product to sell or not to sell? Well, Kenny, probably a two-part answer to this. One, I don't think about selling individual types of products, right? So the way we do this, the way we come at this in Dropship Breakthrough, our program, and the way I teach finding the right products to sell, which might be a bit different to how some other people out there on this planet talk about it. And by the way, those other people are all wrong, is you want to go after the ideal customer. So who's the ideal customer for you? Who are you serving, and what's their interest? What's their passion? And then that will define for you what products you should sell. So I wouldn't recommend that somebody starts a high ticket dropshipping store, for example, that sells just solar generators. That's not a good idea. But could I start a store that is aimed at survivalists or preppers, let's say, and I'm just roughly thinking off the top of my head who might be somebody that might use a solar generator. Let's say preppers. That's a uniquely American thing for you. And, you know, that's my ideal customer, somebody who is into prepping, right? So solar generators could quite potentially be a product that person wants to buy for their preparedness setup, whatever that is. But they're not just going to be buying solar generators, right? They're going to buy a whole bunch of other stuff. Now, so in that circumstance, my business is not going to be a solar generator business. It's going to be a business that serves preppers, and solar generator is going to be just one of the product types that I want to sell to them. Or I could flip it a different way and say somebody who's into, you know, maybe not just the general prepping space, but somebody who's into emergency preparedness. So like they're worried about, you know, like natural disasters or things like that. And they want to be prepared for that. You know, power goes out, they want to have some solar options available to them in that space. But once again, there could be other things that they're interested in, like, you know, clean water, for example, and so on and such forth. So firstly, that's the way you should think about it. Secondly, the question of solar stuff, Well, once again, I think it depends how you're fitting it in, how you're going to fit it in. I think there are a lot of brands of these products that are not great to sell at this point in time because they themselves sell direct to the customer. And that can make the marketing difficult, as in they really actively sell direct to customer, as in they advertise in all the same places that you would, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's some, it's also probably a bit more of a competitive space than it used to be. It's a type of product that a lot of people think up at the moment. So like I said, I definitely wouldn't do it if it was just, if that's all I aim to sell. Look, I know people who are selling solar products in various ways aimed at various different, you know, avenues and different ideal customers who are doing well. So I don't want to say that you can't make money having solar generators as part of your setup, as part of your business, part of your store, but I wouldn't be focusing just on those products in and of themselves. The product themselves, yeah, great to drop ship, right? So it's not big, it's pretty small, it's pretty compact, fairly easy to ship. Prices on them can be pretty decent. So as far as the product itself is concerned, you know, yes, you can definitely drop ship them and they do make a good product to drop ship as in the product, but the market, which is way more important, the competition, the customer, the all of that sort of stuff, you need to be careful around that sort of thing. So thank you, Kenny, for your question. I'm going to change up gears here a little bit and have a Google Ads question. Rad asks, are you still sticking with three-tier campaigns with Google Ads or switching to something else perhaps? PMax? Well, Rad, at this point in time, we are still using our three-tier campaign, Google Shopping campaigns, something that, you know, I've modeled here and shown examples of in this group in lives before. If anybody's listening along and doesn't know what I'm talking about there, we've talked about it a lot on our podcast. So, you know, go back and listen to some of that stuff. But we've been using a fairly consistent approach to Google Shopping ads for years now. We are still using that. However, I will say that we are testing other approaches, primarily Performance Max ads. So this is a Performance Max is one that everybody seems to be getting a bit goosey-loosey about in the online marketing world. Oh, because everybody's mad for automation, so they have to do no work, basically. So PMax gets lazy marketers all wet and juicy for some reason, right? I don't know why. I don't know what the obsession with it is, to be honest. Performance Max is just another Google automation, automated campaigns. They'll basically take your products, take a little bit of targeting information about your audience and just run ads wherever they want to for whatever price they want to, more or less. And you have very little control over it. Now, the idea there is that Google has so much data about all of its users, you know, each of us, they've got like 400,000 data points on all of us, that they think that their AI can, or their algorithms, et cetera, can predict when somebody's more or less likely to make a purchase of a particular type of product and blah, blah, blah. And so they're going to tailor your ads. So you don't have control over your search terms. You don't have control over what you're paying per click, really, and so on and such forth with these campaigns. Now, in theory, this sounds fantastic, right? We can just set up campaigns and they'll go and run and make heaps of sales for us. You know, the reality, though, particularly for high-ticket products and particularly for drop-shipped products where you don't want to be spending unlimited amounts of money to acquire a customer, which in other markets and other types of e-commerce you might be more prepared to do, is that these sort of automated campaigns have never given enough control over cost and cost per sale for them to be viable. And so outside of a couple of very limited circumstances, I've never seen them perform better than standard shopping campaigns in the particular way that we do that, which once again is also not the way that everybody would even use standard shopping campaigns. I have seen them do well for low ticket products that are not drop shipped. So I've worked with some companies back when I used to do ads management and, you know, who had their own products, you know, their own brand, And lower ticket products, though, like sort of $100 or less or thereabouts, you know, somewhere in that sort of field. And automated campaigns did work quite well at that sort of price point and for those sort of products. But once again, you're talking about a business with a different place in the market. They're the only company selling their product, right? You couldn't buy them anywhere else sort of thing. And so it doesn't really compare or relate. But having said that, of course, you know, I'm sure these things are getting better and better when it comes to automation and, you know, AI-driven things and all this sort of stuff. So can I see a place where these sort of tools become more capable? I can see that. And so we are testing that, testing the approach to see if there becomes a point where Performance Max starts to work for a high-ticket drop-shipped products. And definitely when we see that, you know, we'll be recommending people give it a go. And the reality is as well is that from time to time you'll hear about somebody who's had a little bit of success with it. That's fine. But once again, one successful account does not mean it works for everybody. So this is where somebody like me has to be careful, because if one person produces some limited results, that doesn't mean that I can sit here and go, well, now Performance Max works. All hail. Let's all switch over. That's a really quick way to get hundreds and thousands of people that listen to us about this sort of stuff running shitty ads that don't work. So we have to test it. Once it works, then we have to test it on a few more accounts. If the results hold up, you know, good, great. At that point, we'd recommend doing something else, but we're not at that point yet. So thank you for that question, Rad. Next question, I'm going to jump around here to, who have we got here? I'm just going to refresh my screen here so I can see a couple more. Cade. Thanks for the question, Cade. Is there anything that would turn you away from a supplier when just getting started, like red flags? If so, what are they? There are a couple of things, Cade. Certainly, there's probably not much that would turn me away before I've spoken to the supplier. So when I'm first setting up my business, you know, identified what I want to sell, what types of products, you know, I've built my demo website. I've put together a supplier list. I'm going to start calling suppliers. I'm probably going to call and touch base with any supplier that I can find, right, that sells the type of products I want to sell. I'm probably going to go into those conversations without too many preformed notions about whether I want to work with that supplier or whatever. At that point, you're calling them to see if they're open to that sort of business relationship. And, you know, while you don't say it to them, it's really, you know, in your mind, whether you're going to sell their products or not in the end is still an open question. Now, you're having the conversation with them in the sense that that is the plan, and that is the plan. I mean, you are planning to work with them at that stage. You want to work with everybody you can for one of these businesses. One of the secrets to success with high-ticket dropshipping is to get as many suppliers on board and try to sell as many of different variations of the types of products that you want to sell. Right, it's not a case of getting just two or three and calling it quits. If there's 20 suppliers out there, you're aiming to get 20 over time. You're not going to get them all in the beginning, but you're aiming for 20 over time. So you want to go in and have that conversation, because, and you don't want to do it with preformed notions about them, because often what things look like from the outside is not what they're like from the inside, right? And so you just want to start having the conversation and see where they end up. But certainly some of the red flags that make me wary about a supplier. One is going to be competition. So if I see a brand name and I go into, say, Google Shopping to do a bit of research, and I search up those products on Google Shopping, and I see that there's like, 30 different resellers selling that one brand, that automatically to me is going to be like, well, that's too competitive, right? Now, I may still talk to them and I may still work with them, but that's going to get me thinking some things. I'm probably, unless I see a really good reason, I may not want to advertise them, but I may see an avenue to sell them organically. So competition is definitely one. The next one will be margins. So once again, you're not going to know this until you've spoken to them. And that's why I say you want to speak to everybody, right? Because there's things that you can learn that they're only going to share with you after you've spoken to them and after they've agreed to work with you that you just can't know until that point, right? So that's why you've got to have the conversation first. But margins. So if somebody says 10% or less margins, that's usually, maybe not always, but usually going to be a no for me, right? I will talk to them about that first, though. I'm not just going to say, they say 10%. I'm just going to say, okay, thank you, no. I mean, I have to talk to them about that. Like, why is it so low? Okay, like, here's the reality of working with this stuff. We have costs. We've got to cover those costs at 10%. I'm going to be at best breaking even. Probably not. So how do you expect me to run a business? You know, this is a business. It has to make profit. So we need better margins. So I'm going to try and work that with them a little bit. If the products were really high ticket, like $10,000 products, I might do 10% margin because that's still $1,000 per sale, right? So, you know, there might be some exceptions to that rule, but margins is going to be one. So we've got competition, we've got margins. You know, I might kind of red flags might be sort of around, and this might relate to an earlier question, and I don't see this often, but if they have some weird requirements around shipping or really long shipping time frames or something like that, once again, that might make me think a bit harder about whether I want to work with them, whether it's going to put me in a position that makes managing a good business difficult because they have some weird, unusual requirements around fulfillment or something like that. Once again, that's really uncommon, so I don't want to labor that too much, but that might be something I'm looking out for. But yeah, outside of those things, I mean, competition for me, competition, margins, shipping, these are the big things, right? Outside of that, I mean, there can be some other things that make a supplier not great to work with, but I still like to try everything. Keeping in mind as well that the starting point isn't always where you end up. So like you might talk to a supplier and the margins aren't fantastic, but those can change over time. There's plenty of opportunities to get a better margin from a supplier after you start working with them. And sometimes it can be worth taking a great supplier on board at a lower margin because they're good products, they're desirable products. And so you can get your foot in the door at a lower margin and work your way up from there, right? You know, you might come in at 15%, which feels a bit low, but then sell a few products, you got an opportunity to talk to them, move up to 20%. Sell a few more products, got an opportunity to talk to them, move up to 25%. Business being a long-term pursuit, and a dropshipping business is no different, that's something that you really need to keep in mind. Think of the long-term, not the short-term. And so I'm somebody who likes to try everything within a market. Like I want to have a go at selling all the products because, like I say, there's just a lot of things that you can't know before you do that. And so automatically, like putting up barriers to doing particular things within your market can like actually hold you back. I think it's better to get in, try everything, see what works for you, try as many suppliers as you can. Be prepared sometimes as well to do things that other people are not. So we get asked a lot at me and Ben about, well, what's the difference between people who are successful and who are not? Oftentimes the difference is just people who are successful work harder and they do things that other people don't want to. They handle more difficult shipping options, like all these sorts of things, and that gets them further ahead in their market and puts them in a stronger position over time, even though it might be a bit more tricky, and it works out. So anyway, competition, margins, shipping. Those are the main red flags that I would be on the lookout for. Thank you, Cade. All right, next question, jumping along to Chris. Chris asks, when putting together this supplier call list, should I start with distributors of multiple manufacturers first, one or two of them on board would be enough to launch the store, I would think. And if yes, still smart to also work directly with the manufacturer, even if I can already sell their products. Now, that question has just disappeared while I was reading it. Even if I can already sell their products through the distributor. Good question, Chris. And I guess you can probably come at this from two different angles. So for a lot of products out there, once again, just a bit of backstory here for anybody who's not familiar with what we're talking about. Some manufacturers and brands don't supply directly to resellers. They work through a distribution company, which is a third-party company that may have a different name to theirs, that may also work with 4 or 5 or 6 or 10 or 50 different brands. And they're really the brand manages their manufacturing, but they don't want to be in the fulfillment business. So they basically outsource that to somebody else. The warehousing and fulfillment stuff is managed by a third company, and that's your distributor. That's a distributor. Their business is to distribute products, not to make them. And so it's fine to work with distributors. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, sometimes you can find that margins can be a bit lower sometimes, because obviously there's an extra layer added in the overall process from manufacturing to arriving at the customer's door, and that can add in some extra cost and that can reduce margins, but not always. Sometimes distributors can be great to work with too, because that's their business is distribution. So they're kind of really easy to work with because that's what their business is all about. And so they're quite good at it. Sometimes they're not. Look, you could come at it from the perspective of you're going to contact the manufacturers first, and if you have no joy getting supplied direct from them, you're going to work with the, you're then going to approach distributors if that's the direction they send you in. Sometimes you'll call up a brand, you'll say, "Hey, you know, I'm calling from here, want to sell your products, blah blah blah," and they'll say, "Oh, look, yep, fantastic, that's cool, but you need to speak to this company over here, because we don't do that. We don't deal directly with you. You've got to work through a distributor." And that's their requirement. It's not always the case though. So I think my personal approach is always to call the brand themselves first and see if I can work with them, because of course that may open up extra possibilities around things like margins, right? If you can get it direct from the brand. If the brand isn't interested in that, then I'll go to distributors or other companies that might be able to supply me their products. So that tends to be my way of doing it. I think Ben does the same. But you could go the other way. You could work, like get on board with a distributor first. And the cool thing about distributors is that oftentimes they will have multiple brands in your niche. So when you get accepted with the distributor, you're going to get access to all the brands they have. And so, you know, it's kind of like one phone call gets you access to 3 or 4 brands. The flip side of that is you may not get the best margins on those products that you could get. So, but it does get you in the door maybe a bit quicker. So you could take the approach to get those distributors on board first, you know, get the products on your site, because I mean, the product and all the product data is going to be the same either way. And then start selling those products and continue to try and make contact with the brand, the main brand, to see if you can get it directly from them over time. So I think you could take either approach to that. And once again, I don't think there's necessarily a right or wrong. I mean, I probably, once again, prefer making contact with the brand, because I think maybe the earlier you do that, the sooner you get to a point where you might be able to work with them, or you might just be able to work with them from the start. You could go the other approach, and I don't think that's necessarily going to be such a terrible thing. So thank you for that question, Chris. All right. I've got some more questions coming in, and please, if you're watching along here, chuck in some questions if you haven't had a chance to ask one yet. Next question, I think is a follow-up question, which was from Jordan. So a follow-up to his earlier question about about margins. Is there a certain strategy that 25% net profit is the norm? And what's a realistic time frame to hit $10 million in revenue? I'm not sure I understand the first part of that question. 25% net profit is not the norm. If you're asking how can you make it the norm, well, no, there is not a certain strategy to achieve that. Other than, I mean, you could say only work with suppliers that have a certain gross profit, because there's some realities here that you can't foresee. There's your cost per sale, which is different in every market. There's obviously the price of your products. There's your gross profit on those products, which is going to be different supplier to supplier, even within the same business. So there's not a certain strategy that gets you to a particular net profit, if you like. So there's a mix of things. I mean, you once you get up and start selling at volume, like at decent volume, once again, I mean, like talking about selling at $20,000 in sales a month, I mean, that's a great milestone to hit when you're starting from scratch, for sure. So I don't want to downplay that. But I mean, that's not a big business yet. That's not even a probably life-supporting business yet, right? You've got a bit further to go. So once you start getting into some actual volume, then you can see things like, well, what's my cost per sale? What's my rate of repeat business? What's my customer lifetime value? What's, all of these things? What are my margins? Where do they sit with each of my suppliers? Then, at that point, you're going to say, well, I'm at 15% net profit. Are there ways that I can either reduce my costs or increase my gross margins? Or, like, if you think about the three ways that you grow any business, there are only three ways that you grow any business, right? You acquire more first-time customers, you increase your average order value, or you increase your rate of repeat purchases from the same customer. Three ways you grow any business on this planet. It doesn't matter what the business is. It doesn't matter what it sells, services, information products, physical products, whatever. That's the three ways that you can grow a business when you boil them down to their nuts and bolts. So if you can increase your average order value, you may increase your net profit margin as well. If you start selling more products for each order that include a higher gross margin. If you increase your rate of repeat business, you'll tend to increase your margins as well, because you have a very low acquisition cost or no acquisition cost on a repeat purchase compared to a first purchase. So if you get more people coming back and buying from you again, like 3 months later, 6 months later, 12 months later, whatever it is, over time, that is going to build in additional margin to your business, because you're going to get a lower cost per sale on those orders. So each order will have a higher net profit margin, or should do, have a higher net profit margin associated with it. So there's some things there. Obviously, reducing your costs. So if you can find ways to increase your conversion rate, you're going to increase your profit margin off the same cost per acquisition. If you can reduce your cost per acquisition, say by relying less on paid traffic and relying more on organic traffic potentially, or making more sales from email marketing, or more doing better retargeting. I mean, these are all strategies that can improve your margin by reducing your cost per acquisition. So those are things to think about. The other thing I would say, though, I think it's easy to get a bit hung up on net profit percentages, right? I always encourage people don't focus on percentages, right? Do you go to the bank and put a percentage in the bank? No, you don't. You don't go, hey, man, I want to get a loan to buy a house. My net profit percentage is 25%. The bank manager is going to go, get the fuck out of here, idiot. That doesn't mean anything. So ultimately, it doesn't mean anything. I like, your measure of success is dollars. Are you making $10,000 a month, or are you making $50,000 a month? Because quite frankly, if I'm making $50,000 a month or $100,000 a month, like $50,000 a month at 30% net profit, or $100,000 a month at 10% net profit, I'm taking 10% net profit every single day of the fucking week, because I might not be able to go past 50,000 and maintain a 30% net margin, because I have to spend more to go from here to here, right? So that's why percentages are always a red herring. It's same with conversion rate percentages. Like, it's not a measure of success. Going from 10% net profit margin to 25% net profit margin may be success, but it also may not be, because it's hard to maintain high profit margins in percentage terms at large scale. But it doesn't matter, because even at a lower percentage net profit, you can still be making more money in dollar terms in the thing that actually matters. So that's probably the final thing I'll say about percentage profit margins. Realistic time frame to hit 10 million in revenue. Look, it's been done in 2 to 3 years, I would say. Ben, my business partner, and a couple of other guys took one to that sort of run rate in around 2 years. I'll say 2 years. Maybe it was a tiny bit more. I've been part of a business that went to that run rate in its third year, later in its third year in business. So, you know, I mean, that's doable. You know, it could take longer. I mean, theoretically, it could be quicker than that too. Like, once again, there's a lot of factors. As always, there's a lot of factors that go into the time frame that is associated with hitting certain points, right? So realistic time frame, like, I certainly think, you know, if the market conditions are right and if you're doing the right things in the right order at the right times, et cetera, I'd say realistic is 3 years. So thanks for that follow-up question, Jordan. All right, getting back to the list of questions. We've got a question here. How do you go about handling returns? Do you only select suppliers that accept returns? Well, good question. Dropshipping, obviously this is a question that comes up a lot for people who are dropshipping, is returns. It's something that people do worry quite a bit about. And all of that sort of thing. And this was Kenny. Thank you for the question, Kenny. Sorry, I was just looking to see who asked the question. Second thing, no, I don't only select suppliers that accept returns. So I'll answer that part of the question first. but the answer to that is no. How do I go about handling returns? So the first thing to say about returns for high ticket dropshipping businesses is that they are the return rate is very low, and it's a lot lower than it is for pretty much the rest of the e-commerce industry. Part of the reason for that, I believe, is that the customer does a lot more research. There's a lot more thought and there's a lot more on the line for the customer. So people don't just buy high ticket products usually on impulse, which they might for an item of clothing or some low ticket thing. They see an ad for it on social media and they go, oh yeah, I'm going to buy that. And they just go and buy it right then and there, because losing $40 on a shitty product for the average person doesn't matter. Right, in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter to them. They're not going to notice that not being there, and so that's why people buy things on impulse. When you're selling a $3,000 product, people don't just see that on social media and go, "Oh shit, yeah, I'm going to go and buy that $3,000 product right here and now without thinking about it." Right, which is why we don't advertise on social media. very much. So the customer is going to go out, they're going to do some research. They're going to think about how the product meets their needs. They're going to think about the outcome they're after. And does the product have all of the features and benefits that are going to provide that outcome? They're probably going to compare some products. They're going to compare some different retailers to each other that sell those products. And so there's a much longer customer journey here, which means by the time the customer gets to the end of it, they're pretty certain they want that product. And so usually if it turns out they want to send it back, it's going to be because something has changed for them or something or another. It's rarely that they get the product there and they look at it and they go, oh, this is completely not what I ordered. I want to send this back. It's not going to fit or whatever. That's pretty rare, right? It's also more of a commitment. They feel like high ticket products tend to be larger. They feel harder to send back. Like, you know, I've got a business where the average product that I sell weighs, you know, between 75 and 120 kilos. For the Americans, I don't even know what that is in pounds, but that's something that's on a pallet. You can't pick it up by yourself. It's a big thing. Sending that back seems really hard, right? Like I wouldn't want to have to ship that back to a retailer. It just seems hard. So people tend not to go down the path of purchasing it. Like people don't purchase things in the high ticket space with the thought that I'm going to want to send this back, right? If you're in the right market, the right niche, people are buying these things because they're passionate about them. They have some interest in them, et cetera, et cetera. They actually want to have the product. They want it to work out for them. They want it to be the right thing. Now, yes, you do get the odd dodgy idiot out there who does things like chargebacks, even though they got the product. And like that does happen. But these things are, on average, very rare. So like the return rate for a high ticket dropshipping business can be less than 1% of orders, right? I mean, I've got a fairly new business. I've done over 100,000 in sales as of now. And, you know, started it this year. I haven't had a single return. I haven't even had a request for a return yet on that business. So, and that return rate would, you know, even if I had one, it would be less than 1% at this point in time. So it's not something that I'm losing a lot of sleep over. How do I handle it? Well, I mean, usually on a high ticket dropshipping store, I'm going to have at least a 30-day return policy. And once again, this is me personally. I'm not saying this is what you need to do, but this is what I do. I'll have a 30-day return policy. If somebody asks for a return, it's got to be in as new condition. It can't be out of its packaging. Like once again, if I'm talking about one of these products that ship on a pallet, etc., they're packaged up, they're strapped up, all that sort of thing. Customer takes it out of all of that packaging and takes it out of its box, etc., etc. It can't go back in, can't be resold. And there are products actually that you can't sell them as new again if they're unboxed as well. So policy is it's got to be in the same condition you received it in if you want to send it back. So once it's out of its box, no returns. And I'm leaving aside defective products or warranty or anything like that. That's a completely different thing. What we're talking about here is change of mind returns. Like I've got the product and I'm like, oh, no, actually, I don't want that product. I'm going to send it back. So leaving aside those things, defective returns, all that sort of, I mean, the supplier, that's the supplier's deal, right? That's not even your deal. If the customer wants to return it and it's, you know, it's in the condition I say it needs to be in, then I'm going to obviously look at the supplier's policy. Does the supplier accept returns? Do they not? If they do, I'm going to obviously arrange to get it back to the supplier. Once again, you can have a different approach to that. Some people will cover the cost of the return for their customers. Obviously, this makes your return policy look better, which is something customers do consider pre-purchase. Other people say the customer has to pay return shipping. If it's going back to the supplier, it'll go back to the supplier. It gets back to the supplier checks it, it's fine. You process a refund. Maybe you get a refund from the supplier. Maybe you just get a credit with them for your next order. If I can't send it back to the supplier, well, then I've got some options there. I could, and what I personally, again, have done for years is I can get it supplied to me, like returned to me, and I can hold that product either where I live if I've got the space to do that, or if I have some other business space somewhere, I can have it sent there. I can hold the product until I sell that product again and then just ship it from my location. There are some cool things about doing that. Once again, you have the product. You could do things with the product, like take pictures of the product, take videos of the product. If it's a product that obviously that you can do that with, if it's all packaged up and whatnot, you might not want to do that, but you might. So there's options there. I've had return products that I then went and did a big giveaway on, and I gave it away, you know, if I didn't need to resell it, and ran a big competition, got tons of emails, which led to further sales, et cetera, down the track. But once again, you just hold on to it until you sell that product again. Usually for products that you sell, you don't sell them just once. You'll sell it again. And so you just ship it straight out. You're not over time losing money in that way. So that, I mean, those are two options. You could work with a 3PL. We mentioned that earlier on an early question, third-party logistics companies. You could work with one of those and you can ship a return back to them and they can hold it for you until you sell it again. And then they can ship it out again. So that's something that some 3PLs can do for you. So there are options there, or you could just have a more restrictive returns policy. I mean, that's obviously your option as well. If you want to have like a no returns policy, you could have a no returns policy. But once again, there's a competitive element to that. Like that's your returns policy is part of your policy, is part of your overall offer. So if you've got a really crappy returns policy and everybody you're competing against has a better one, then that is something that a portion of customers are going to be considering, even if they have no intention of using it. This is called risk reversal. It's a marketing 101 term, risk reversal. The more you can reverse the risk from your customer to your business, the more sales you will make, right? It's not about all of those risks being realized, but part of being a business owner is accepting risk. If you don't like risk, then don't start a business. Super blunt advice for anybody listening. If you don't like risk or you can't stomach risk, as in you might temporarily be without money sometimes, a portion of money, whether it's because of advertising, whether it's because of returns, whatever, then you should not start a business. You are not yet in the mental space to be in business. That's a simple, might be a hard fact for some people to stomach, but that's the reality. This is why a majority of people do not run businesses. It's because they are fearful of the risk involved with doing so. And that's okay. It's not for everybody, right? That is part of it. So the more risk you can take off the customer and place on your business, the more you're going to sell, because in the circumstance where you're selling to the customer and you have no returns policy, you're essentially saying to the customer, you must take on all the risk in this transaction. As in, if there's something wrong with the product or it's not what you thought it was going to be or whatever, you're stuck with it, buddy, and you're out of pocket. I'm going to keep your money, even though, you know, I may or may not have delivered on what I agreed to. So the customer has all the risk. So put yourself in the customer's shoes. Why would you order if you have to take all the risk on a high ticket product? Very different to a low ticket product. Whereas if you can take some of the risk off and say, look, if it doesn't work out, I got you covered. I'm going to give you a refund and I'm going to take responsibility for the product. You're going to get more people ordering from you. So just something to bear in mind. You know, kind of marketing 101, the old risk reversal. But thanks for the question. It's a good question. Do I require pictures in follow-up to that question? No, I don't require pictures. If you're talking about a return and it being in a particular condition, I don't need pictures before it gets sent back. If it comes back and it's not in the condition it needs to be, and the customer's just not going to get a return, and I'm going to keep the product. Simple. If it is, fine. Do I require pictures when something gets delivered to it, try and help avoid chargebacks? Yeah, ideally, if the shipping company does that sort of stuff, and a lot of them do these days, that is helpful. All right. All right. You've made it through. If you've stuck it out this long, thanks as always for listening to the show. We really appreciate you being here and listening to this episode. Now, if you've got come through that and you're thinking, man, I've really got a lot of questions that I'd love to ask about dropshipping and high ticket dropshipping, about business, about online business, whatever it might be, well, there's avenues for you to get in and put those sort of questions to both myself and Ben. And one of the best ways you can do that is to join our free and public Facebook group. So I mentioned it at the start, and that's where all of those questions you just heard were asked and answered. If you'd like to be a part of that, all you have to do is go down below this video into the show notes. If you're listening to the podcast, whether you're on Spotify or Apple, the link will be there to the Facebook group. All you got to do is click that link and ask to join the group, and we'll let you right on in. If you're on YouTube and you've been watching this video, nice to see you, or you can see me, head into the description underneath the video, and once again, you will find the link to the Facebook group there, and you can go ahead and join, and then you can post these sort of questions, anything at all. We get all sorts of questions in there and we answer every single one of them. So make sure you do that. And look, if you'd love to get your high ticket dropshipping business started, if you'd love to start down that journey, and if you'd love to do it with even more support and more content and more information and more hand-holding, everything than what we do on this podcast or in our free Facebook group, for example, get into Dropship Breakthrough. All you need to do is head to dropshipbreakthrough.com/join. Once again, you can see the link below the video, the podcast episode, wherever you're consuming this content, and you can get straight into our program and work directly with Ben and I and our network of over 700 other high-ticket dropshipping business owners, people just like you, and do it with our full support. So head to that link today, join up, and we'll see you inside.
Thanks for listening to the Dropship Podcast. You can find all the show notes for this episode at dropshippodcast.com. And if you're ready to take the next step in your dropshipping journey, we invite you to join us inside Dropship Breakthrough, where John and I will walk you through step-by-step in starting your own high-ticket dropshipping e-commerce business. But that's not all. Dropship Breakthrough will also teach you everything you'll need to know to grow your business and take it to the next level. So head over to dropshipbreakthrough.com and sign up for our free training that will help you take the first steps towards building and growing your own profitable high-ticket dropshipping business.
John and I both love business, think about it all the time, can't turn it off, and don't know why anyone would want to. And because of that, we started a second podcast where we can talk about everything we've ever wanted to talk about in business. Not just dropshipping. We like talking about all things business. So if you want to hear John and I talk about all sorts of stuff, from camel meat dropshipping businesses to PDF dropshipping to a guy gambling $100 every single day on YouTube Shorts to how OnlyFans taught us lessons in business, we're all over the place over there, but it's a really fun podcast. So if you're a podcast listener, you love John and I, head over to your podcast player of choice and look for the Low Bar Podcast. You'll see a blue image, and you'll see a cartoon version of John and myself. And go back and start at episode one. I promise you will not regret this. This is one of the more fun projects that I have done recently. I know John's having fun too, so we'd love it if you joined us. Check out the Low Bar Podcast on YouTube or wherever you prefer to listen to podcasts.